about presenting writing. These are very important skills. So pretty much we have covered really the very important skills. So now we'll talk about other things that are important, I guess less central to scientists working, but also important. Do you have any questions about reading and writing and presenting? No? Okay. So today, I'm going to talk about a skill that is not exactly something that you are going to do immediately, soon, but it's a skill that you need to learn, to develop over the next few years. Because once you are done with your PhD, very likely you are going to have your own group. You are going to guide students, probably at first bachelor's and master's students, but then in the longer run, when you get a faculty position, and most of you will probably follow the academic path, you will be the boss yourself. Another thing that you can do with this knowledge is maybe look at your own environment, look at how your advisor is running the lab, how his or her colleagues are doing that, and kind of draw your conclusions. This is something that typically we are not taught as engineers, and you have to kind of figure it out yourself. So the story, part of this presentation, big part of this presentation, is something that I... why is it not... I really have... Looks like I have bad luck today. Things are not working. What is this? Is it my it's not working. Looks like I'm having a bad day today. Change the sockets, maybe. No. Oh, it's working now. So, the story behind this is that I was at some point I have been I've been given a an award at the university. They called it Outstanding Mentor Award. So I guess my students had nominated me, and then there was some voting and some interviews, I guess, and I got the award. And then they asked me to give a presentation on the topic of how I run my lab. That reminds me of a story. When I was a young father, my second son, I think, he was a scout. He was in Boy Scouts. And there was a weekend where the scouts were fishing with their fathers. So it was just my son and me on a boat in a big lake. There were many teams like this, father and son. And I thought we did very well. We caught, like, I don't know, 5 or 6 fishes. Kind of this type, but, you know, very small. I thought we did well. And then we came at the end of the competition, 5 o'clock, I think, to the shore. And then they announced the winners. And the winner had like, I forgot, but it was like 70 pounds of fish, 30-something kilograms. I thought, wow, that's incredible. How did they do that? And the catch was that those winners had to tell everybody how they did it. So what kind of lures they were using, how they were fishing. I guess the same thing here. When I got this award, they asked me to give a presentation. I was given half an hour, maybe 40 minutes, and I had to sit down and think how I did it. So that's a large part of the presentation is actually based on that. But not everything. I have added a few things. So you remember from the very first meeting, in science, the training happens through this master-apprentice model. So people are learning from one another. You are learning from an older, more advanced colleague. So now I'm going to talk about what you do when you are the advanced colleague and you have less advanced people that you want to prepare for science. The best place to do graduate studies is where there are a lot of good academics. If you have the choice, I mean, you have already made commitments, but if you have the choice, I would go to the best possible place. Best possible means the most Nobel Prizes and the most publications, you know. That's what I would choose, because there you can learn from the people, from the best people, and follow their model. As a trainee, you will get a lot of things that you wanted, but you also, sometimes you didn't want. You learn a lot of things from your parents. Remember, I told you that if you, when you are typically 30-something, you will notice in yourself things that you didn't like in your parents. And that's a terrible experience. Suddenly, you are 35, and you have children, and you realize, oh boy, I just did something that I hated in my parents. That tells me about things that you learn that you didn't want to learn. You didn't like it, but you learned. So you are all, as a student, as a trainee, you are going to learn a lot of things. Things that you wanted and things that you didn't want to learn. Well, that says something about being a mentor, being a parent. You have to watch out because your children or your advisees will learn things from you that you didn't want to teach them. And you have to do it alone. There is a concept in academia called, people refer to it as academic freedom. When you are teaching a course, for example, typically people don't tell you what to do, how to organize the course. You sit down, spend a few days and design a course. The same with organizing your lab. People don't tell you how to do it. You just have to sit down and think and do it the way you think is a good idea. That's actually a very nice thing about this job, that you have a lot of freedom and you can invent things, you can try them out. It's really wonderful. And you have to do it alone. So how to do it? What are, remember, I often referred in this course to the Far Eastern martial arts. Remember, I mentioned this movie, Karate Kid, when the kid is learning the basics. I told you about this experience in Kendo where we had to walk for an hour all the time around the room with a master. The foundations, the basics, are very important. So what are the foundations here? Tenure is a permanent position at a university in US. There's an equivalent of that everywhere. So if you become a professor, well, first an assistant professor here, there are also evaluations. They decide whether to offer you a permanent position or not. So first advice that I always give to my doctoral students is forget about it. Don't worry about permanent position. If you remember, Kenneth Olden was talking about this. People who worry about permanent position, they ended up going down and down and down because they took safety over their careers. So don't worry about it. When you do good work, things will come. Publications will come and also permanent position. Even your PhD will come when you work hard, when you do good work. Take control over your academic life. So don't let others control your life. Just do it yourself. Do what you think is right. Find out also what is important for you. And in the context, if you remember, we talked about finding research topics, the concept of secret weapon. Think about your strengths. What is it that you are very good at? Because then you will get the best out of yourself. You will do better. Think about what you like, what you love, what your strengths are. And base your approach on your strengths. And another thing, scientists should not be afraid to experiment. So try things. If they don't work, do it, but better. Try different things. It reminds me of an anecdote about Thomas Edison. Somebody came to him and said, well, this electric bulb that you invented, it's a wonderful thing. It must have been very risky because how did you know it would work? And he said, well, I tried 100 different things. None of them worked. So this one had to work. at some point things will work. Experiment with them. So how have I approached it? And again, they forced me to think about this and to share it with others. I think the foundations. My grandfather, who spent, I forgot how many, I think 7 years or so, in the Tsar's army. They drafted young men from Poland to serve in the Russian army. That was the time that Poland was dependent. He was telling to his sons, who were my uncles, if you are a soldier, be a good soldier. Because if you are not a good soldier, then you get killed, and your colleagues will also get killed, right? So don't chicken out. Do what you are supposed to do. Be a good soldier. There's another inspiring story. I thought, if I'm doing this, I'd better be good, because otherwise, what's good of being not a good academic? Life is too short to do things so-so. I think there's a song by, forgot his name. Życie jest zbyt krótkie, żeby żyć byle jak. Life is too short to live kind of so-so. So do things well. And that's me with my mother. And I think that the most important thing that you can give a child, and my mother gave it to me, is, this feeling that you are accepted, loved, but also she taught me to love others. And I think it was a very good, very important foundation. Because if you are a teacher, you have to love your students. If you don't love your students, well, you'd better change your career. You do something else. Because a lot of things that you are going to do in this environment, then you are essentially, part of your life is for your students, for the people. Somebody called it once, a colleague of mine called it in a conference, human sacrifice. Essentially, you bring up your doctoral students, send them to the world, and they are changing the world, the way you wanted it to be changed. It's a human sacrifice. Of course, that was a joking way of saying that. There are two inspiring stories. If you haven't read about them, there's about this one, there's actually a movie, an American movie titled Stand and Deliver. It's a story about a teacher, actually a computer scientist, Jaime Escalante, in Los Angeles. He wanted to be a teacher. All his life he dreamt about being a teacher. So he decided to quit his well-paying programmer's job, just quit it, and started working at a high school. High school in East Los Angeles, which is a Hispanic neighborhood, where boys join gangs, when girls become pregnant, drop out of high school, not a very good neighborhood. And he came there with a lot of enthusiasm, says that he wanted to teach computer science. They started laughing at him. There are no, these kids cannot do it, and there are no computers in this school, so he cannot do it here. Then he started teaching, I think, mathematics, and then he decided to have the students in the high school to take advanced placement courses. Advanced placement is, in the U.S., it's a system where in a high school you can take advanced classes which give you credit when you join the university. So he started teaching calculus. Calculus, rachunek różniczkowy, całkowy. In Poland, classes with a mathematics profile teach that, but it's an advanced material, and that's an advanced placement course. Everybody was laughing at him. People, his colleagues at the school said, well, you cannot do that. You will only frustrate the kids, because you set the goals high and they cannot do it. They are not that smart, those kids. So they will be very frustrated, disappointed, and in the end you will hurt them. That was the environment that he was working in. He worked with those kids. He made a deal with them. He worked with them over the summer. They show in the movie very hot days where the kids were sweating instead of playing, fooling around in the summer. They were sitting in the class. And what happened is all of them there were like 15 or 20 kids, they passed the exam. The exam is central, so like Polish Matura, it's a central organization that takes those exams. Then, interesting story, the company that does the tests, Educational Testing Services, suspected that they were cheating, because nobody in the past has taken those exams in this school, and all of them passed, and some of the mistakes were the same in kids. So they suspected cheating. Of course, he was quite mad about this. When they administer those exams, there is just the teacher, there are no people from outside. But then they decided, we want to retest those kids. So they came with a group, you know, they were watching all the kids. First they were interviewing them. Did you cheat? No. How did you cheat? Etc. You know, very funny conversations. But they were not cheating. In fact, the errors were because he made errors as a teacher. He taught them things that were wrong. And, you know, they made the same mistakes, essentially. So the second time they took the test, all of them passed again. And this was very well supervised. So, and he was quite upset about this whole suspicion towards his kids. So they passed again, and he demanded that they reinstate the original scores, the original results, which was kind of, you know, nice. And then in the movie ends like, you know, he the next year and next year and next year, the number of kids passing that test was higher and higher. Very inspiring story. And then a quotation from him. I think that's literal. I found it. I think it's very important. If you expect kids, so students, or your children, if you expect them to be winners, they will be winners. If you expect them to be losers, they are going to fail. Kids raise to the level of teachers' expectation. It's amazing, you know. Kids are usually very smart, and they will essentially match the level of your expectation. What does it tell us as future teachers or mentors, people who are educating others? Well, expect a lot. If you remember from the lecture by Randy Pausch, the advice he got from his mentor, he asked, what do I do, sensei? And he said, go to your kids and tell them, because if you tell them good, very good work, you essentially set the bar low. If you tell them, you know, you are going to do them a disservice. So tell them, this was good, but I think you can do more, right? So expect a lot, and then you will get it. Of course, expect, but don't just tell them I expect. Guide them, help them to achieve. I think it's a very important principle in bringing up kids, in educating people, in teaching also. High expectations, because the kids will race to it. If they like the environment, they will try to do their best. So that was very inspiring to me, I think. Another inspiring story is there was a Polish general, Sosabowski, during the Second World War. He was in England, of course, you know, he went south to Romania, then France. When France fell, he was in England. He is pictured in the movie One Bridge Too Far. It's about the invasion in Normandy, where he is pictured, he's played by Gene Hackman, a very good American actor. He says a few Polish words. I remember Schnur was difficult for him. The story is very inspiring because as recruits, people who he was expected to train, he got really pretty much not very good material for soldiers. They were not very physically fit, they were not handicapped maybe, but they were not too good. He trained them in such a way that they actually were excellent soldiers. In that movie, they show actually a tragic moment. He was, from the very beginning, he thought the plan was not very good. They kind of silenced him there. And in the task he has received, he lost a lot of soldiers. That's shown in that movie. They were supposed to cross a river under fire. He lost a lot of people. It's an inspiring story that you can... the quote is not really his. I know that's the story, so I put it. You can make top soldiers out of everybody. So sometimes when you think you don't get good kids, you don't get the smartest, it's important, but not that important. Not as important as working hard and being inspired, I think. So that's another important thing when you have people, when you are guiding people. This is a slide that I have to say that this is a quote from Lao Tzu, a Chinese philosopher, long ago. And I have to say that I didn't understand that quote, and I still have, I'm still having my doubts if I understand it correctly. The quote consists of four statements, or three or four statements, but the first one is the following. The wicked leader is he who the people despise, so people don't like him, right? That's obvious, right? Not a very good leader if people don't like him. Good leader is he who the people revere, so they think, wow, he's a good leader. That's definitely it sounds better than the first one. That's the third one. The great leader is he who the people say, we did it all by ourselves. Right? It wasn't him. We did it. This is what I don't understand. I think I understand. I have at least two interpretations of that, that I think both make sense. But if you have another one, absolutely, definitely say something here. How do I understand it? The way I understand this quote is that there are two aspects of that. The second leader that people revere, the leader dies, and what happens? Where our great leader died, and slowly the idea, the school also starts dying, right? Because the leader is not there. Look, in the third case, when the people, after the death of the leader, say, wow, he died, okay, fine, we'll light a candle, we will revere him, but we did it all by ourselves anyway, so not a big event. We just continue doing this, yes? So that's the first aspect, I think. People have been trained enough to do it by themselves. And death of the leader is not a big event. The thing continues. That's the first aspect, I think, that is important. The second aspect that I think is a little, tiny bit selfish, I think. If you are a leader like this, then you have less work to do. Because you don't have to do it, your people will do it, yes? They will do it, they will learn doing this, and they will also think they did it by themselves. Well, because they do it by themselves. So, less work, you can kind of sit back and do the important things, like do some guidance, help them a little bit, but they do it by themselves. So that's the way I understand that quote. I do think it's a wise quote. So being praised is not enough. You have to educate your people to be independent. And while doing that, you have also less work because they are independent. You don't do the groundwork. Here's another version. A leader is best when people barely know he exists. So he's kind of, he or she is a little bit on the side, not doing all the work, but showing how to do it. When his work is done, his aim fulfilled, they will say, we did it ourselves. Interesting idea. The algorithm for being a mentor, a leader, a boss, I think, is definitely iterative. So you experiment, because you start when you are young, and you are learning all your life, so you kind of, experiment, correct, do it again, better and better, I think. When we die, we are going to be very wise, yes? In the beginning, we don't have the experience. We have to keep learning this. What is important, I think? An important thing is that when your students, your people, develop their careers and are leaders themselves in the future, that they do it better than you do. Even your children the same. You want your children to reach higher than you have ever reached. I think it's an important thing. And that takes a little bit of a modesty in you. Never be jealous of your students. Be proud of them. In fact, you should educate your students, your people. When they achieve success, maybe you can you can get your payment in the following way. She was my student, of course. That's why she got Nobel Prize. Maybe you don't need to say that, but she was my student is enough. That's the reward that you get. But don't ever, it's natural that your children reach higher and your people. You want them to get the best out of themselves, so the best things that are in them. So sometimes you have to help them to see those best things, and that's part of being a leader, being a parent also. Help them to see what they are really good at. Praising people is very important. Praising children, of course, you don't say good job, good job, good job when they screw up. You don't do that. But when they do something well, when they do something good, you say that to them. I heard it for several times from my colleagues when I was still a PhD student, that the advisor saying something like, wow, this was a good job. You did it really nicely. That's an incredible kick. You really get, it's something that stimulates you a lot. So when you are a leader, don't be afraid of saying something good. Of course, when it's deserved, don't keep doing this. Because if you say it's good, it's good, it's good all the time, of course it's worthless. But when you see something good done, say it. They have to accomplish it by themselves, according to that quote from Lao Tse. So don't lead them by the hand. This is a tendency that young leaders have. When I was freshly out of my PhD, I was a faculty member, I had my PhD students. First, I was desperate to get my PhD students. I wanted to have, it's kind of so nice to have students. Because then in a conference, you can say, oh, this is John, he's my PhD student. That's the the desperation, I'll talk about this later. Don't be desperate, but when you have your students, you want them to succeed, and then the natural thing is to do for them. This reminds me of a parent, let's say a mother, who has a daughter. The daughter is already, I don't know, 10 or 12, and the daughter has a messy room. A mother thinks, it will take me 5 minutes to clean it up. It will take a bottle and 2 hours for her to clean it up, so I'll do it myself. Don't do that. Tell them, show them maybe how to do it, how to clean the room, the child, but let them do it themselves. And then they will really feel very well after accomplishing the cleaning. It was so easy. It took only 2 hours, and I did it, right? They have to learn a lot, and the easiest way is to learn from you. The same like children. The children learn from parents, so make sure that they have something to learn from you. They need support, like children. They cannot earn the money to buy clothes and food, so you have to buy clothes and food for them. When you bring them up, you need to support them. The same with your people. You need to support them, both materially and mentally. Materially is, help them to get a stipend, get a computer, a desk for them when you have people. Things that they cannot do, you as a leader have to take care of that. Mentally, that's, of course, talking with them, sometimes pointing things out, criticizing sometimes. That's the mental support that they need to get. I guess to summarize this, it's inspire, so make them see that they can accomplish things, show them the possibilities. Sometimes people don't know the possibilities, and that's important to show them that what they can do. When you have more experience, you will see further, you will see better what can be done. Show them how to do it, let them see you doing this, but at the same time, let them do it by themselves. Have to do it. I think you've seen this slide. I believe I had it earlier. Anyway, it appears in a few places. So it's important that you love what you do, or you do what you love. There's a saying in Polish: "Gdy się nie ma co się lubi, to się lubi co się ma." That's funny. If you don't have what you like, you should like what you have. Yes. In case of academic careers, I assume that most of you have chosen them because you it attracts you, you like it. And keep it that way, like it. If you don't like it, maybe life is too short to do things that you don't like. So consider changing your career. But if when you whatever you do like, if you do it, if you like it, as one of my mentors said, then you are going to achieve more because all people who've been successful had to work long hours, work very hard on something, and it's impossible to do if you don't like it. So you do, you get more when you do something that you like. You have to be a role model. A role model is somebody who is worth imitating, who is worth looking at and learning from. It's kind of amazing how many kind of small level things are the same in being a parent. Parent and having children who are observing you all the time. If you don't have children yet, you will see that. Maybe you observe other children. They are hearing more than you would like them to hear. They are learning and they are repeating more than you would like them to. I told you the story about the toothbrush. I think I must have. Yeah, that's that was scary, really, to me. So they learn by observation. They are absorbing, stealing your knowledge. But the academic environment is one where people don't mind when the students, their advisees are stealing the knowledge. It's one of the environments that I love because of that. I worked also, I worked once for 1.5 years at IBM, one of the biggest research centers in the world. There were, I think, 1,400 scientists working in just a couple of buildings. Amazing, full of really very smart people. And it was a nice place, very good. But I still didn't like that people were hiding things from each other. Like, I wanted to port an operating system from one computer to another. The author of the operating system said, well, it's not ready, you will not be able to do it, etc. He didn't want me to do it. People were kind of hiding things. That I don't think I've ever met that in academia. In academia, it's a very open environment where knowledge is really transferred to the younger people. I love that. It's the same like parents. Parents don't hide good things from the children. Whatever they have best, they try to transfer to the children. The same idea here. Expose yourself and make it worth stealing from you. So make the people actually thinking, wow, I'd like to do what she's doing, what he is doing. If they respect you, they will learn more from you. Just like, you know, kids and parents. The same thing, really. If they don't like the parents, they will learn less from them. At some point when they are teenagers, they will start noticing that their parents are not ideal. And it's worse. The same with being a mentor. If they respect you, they will learn more from you. So make sure that they respect you. I don't mean by forcing them to respect you, but essentially be a person who is respected naturally. If you want to produce first-class scholars, you have to be first-class scholar yourself, because otherwise they will not learn from you. Just like a parent, if you want to bring up loving, honest children, be loving and honest yourself. If you are not, forget it. You will never learn to teach the children that. You have to try to get the best of yourself first, and then from the people. A leader is not the one who says, attack that way, but follow me. I'm going first, right? It's a very important principle. The best leaders are going first and the others are following. So the students are really younger colleagues, and I really think we should think about it that way. Because sometimes you will encounter people who are thinking, okay, student is a... Are human beings a little bit lower on the ladder, and therefore I can abuse them, right? And that's a very silly way of doing this, because your students very often they will go further than you. They may be your bosses, in fact. So, think about this. They are your younger colleagues, younger, sometimes in terms of age, in terms of experience, typically that's true, but they are your colleagues, and treat them as your colleagues. With respect. The same with children, by the way. The children, I think Janusz Korczak was saying something about children, something to the effect that they are almost like adults, you know. They just think a little differently, but you have to treat them seriously like adults. I do think it's a good idea to treat children also with full respect and just less experienced humans than you are. A personal role model, there is more than professional contact. There is also personal contact. So set a good example in ethics, collegiality, civil service, etc. I thought that Randy Pausch was giving examples, if I remember, of that. So the lab needs cleaning. You don't say, would you please clean? But you, as the leader, say, okay, I'll clean today, but next week is going to be you, then you, and then you, right? It's much better, more effective. You can do small things. One of my older colleagues, when I was a faculty, he did the following. He announced a competition for a name of a product they were developing, a research product, and he said the main prize is Dr. Thompson, that's his last name, will wash your car. Dr. Thompson will wash the car of the winner. Look how beautiful that thing is. It's a beautiful example of humility. Yes? Dr. Thompson, the big guy, is going to take your car and wash it. Wow. It's almost like, you know, you have in Christianity, Jesus Christ is washing the feet of his disciples. That's the same idea, I think, showing the humility and... That's very impressive, really. Act naturally, be yourself, so that they will be such, of course, at the same time that they will find worth following you. Do not let the students see unethical things that you are doing, and that means, plainly, do not do unethical things. It's like I told you about the toothbrush. The scary thing was I no longer could, if I did, pick my nose, right? Because if my son sees that, wow. He will do it the same way too, but when he is a teenager, he will disrespect me because he saw me picking my nose, right? And I tell him, don't pick your nose. Just don't do it. That is very simple. If you want them to be ethical, don't do anything unethical. Children don't do what you tell them to do, but they do what they see you do. They do what you do. The same with mentoring. Personal interactions. Introduce, in addition to the meetings, like, you know, you have 1 hour a week meeting with people individually, have also informal meetings, like, I feel like having coffee. Would you like, do you want to go to Starbucks for coffee? Or to Caffaietto to coffee? There's Caffaietto close, right? Take your student to coffee. It used to be like that. I think in some places there is still, I don't know about England now, but it used to be that the lab leader would go to have beer on Friday evening with the students. It was when I started, when I was a student and then a young faculty, in US there was already a lot of pressure not to do things like that because of the possibility of being accused of sexual harassment. So if I take a female student, oh, would you like to go to lunch with me? That can be kind of misunderstood, right? I haven't done that. I don't think I've ever done it. Even I could have a meeting with a female student. I wouldn't take a female student for a drink or to, you know, to coffee individually, maybe in a small group. And you have to take that into account. Don't do things that could be understood not completely clearly, so don't do that. But definitely the informal settings, the, you know, just go out, why don't we go and play frisbee together? Or go to a football game together. Get the tickets, actually, for your students. So the informal meetings are important. They see you in other situations. You can go for a walk, whatever. Interactions are more relaxed. My wife sometimes, she's surprised that I sometimes knew so much about my students. Oh, you know, he has problems in his marriage. How do you know it? Well, the student told me himself. I didn't ask him. I didn't interrogate him. How is your marriage? I never ask questions like this. But when you are, you know, when you are in an informal settings, people tend to open up. Why would you want that? There are reasons for that. It's not that you are curious about their marital life. No, but if they have any type of problems, you want to be aware of them, and sometimes you can even support them, help them. One of my students came to me and said, well, my girlfriend is pregnant. That's a real story, actually. What do you think about it? Yeah, things like that happen also. And then, you know, tell what you think about this, frankly. Of course, tell them that, you know, it's their decision, but tell them what you think about this. Conversations like that happen also, and I don't think it's a good idea to kind of escape from them. There was once, I told you that this whole course is inspired by Saturday workshops once a month at the University of Pittsburgh. When I was a young faculty, I attended them. They were called Survival Skills and Ethics Workshops. And they had interesting lectures, but also discussions over lunch. There was once, I remember, a discussion about ethics. An advisor and a student, I forgot, male or female, so it doesn't matter, said, I think it was a female student, who said after 1 year of working in the lab where she was trained, a lot of investment, a lot of training, she said after 1 year that she has to leave the lab. She already had, you know, the advisor shared a lot of information with her research idea. They did a lot of things together. And she said she has to leave. Why? Well, because her father is sick and she wants to spend time with the father now that he is sick. And then in the case study, I think the advisor was upset about this because a year-long investment and the student suddenly says, I'm leaving. I remember that one of the things that in the discussion that we asked, I forgot who was, maybe it was me who asked, how come that the advisor learns about this 1 year after the beginning of the student starting? I think it's a good idea to know it earlier. Why? Why is it a good idea to know it earlier? Because if I had known it, and this was my student, a good student, I would probably try to find arrangements for her to work remotely, for example. Right? For example, to support her in that difficult time, and or even, you know, early on, if that was impossible, I probably would advise her, you know, maybe you should take a leave of absence, take a year leave, spend it with your father. Just an advice, you know. So being suddenly surprised after 1 year and not knowing what to do, being upset, that's a very funny situation, I think. So when you know what is happening with your people, you can offer help, I think. That's the main reason. So just don't be too far from them. Don't just restrict yourself to professional level. Of course, be very careful. You cannot ask people or put pressure or require to share with you personal information. Not. That's absolutely unethical and probably also illegal. But if you have a little closer contact, you will know them better. That means that you will be able to help them better, to guide them. So don't go away from that. In Poland, it's not popular, maybe because we don't have so many foreign students. But in US, what we did is every time there was a holiday like 4th of July. 4th of July is Independence Day. the entire United States goes to do barbecues with the whole family, you know, in the field, summer on the grass. What do? Well, you invite your students also. There are 20 people in your house anyway, so, you know, five more, that's fun, right? The same with the biggest U.S. holiday, which is the biggest probably because it's really non-denominational. So it's completely outside of any religion. It's a Thanksgiving holiday. All Americans give thanks to, you know, to commemorate the first Thanksgiving dinner when the first settlers were having dinner with the local population, with Indians, with Native Americans. So all Americans travel to their families, typically big dinner with a turkey. Why turkey? Because it's a big bird. You cannot eat it yourself. You know, you have to share it. That's a nice thing. So you share it with other people. What do? You invite your PhD students too, foreigners, of course, because Americans will go to their families. But foreign students, they don't know what to do. I sometimes, you know, ask, not my student, what did you do for Thanksgiving dinner? Well, we went to McDonald's and had a turkey sandwich. That's a very sad thing. It's almost like, you know, Christmas Eve in Poland. What did you do for Christmas Eve? Oh, you know, I had all the stores were closed, all the restaurants were closed, so I had, you know, the Chinese instant soup. This is comparable to that. So get your students to join you. Christmas, I think it's more in Poland. This is our biggest holiday, probably. Just if you have people who don't have family closely, who are alone, just invite them. I think it's a good idea. Of course, Polish students will join their families, unless they don't, so you invite them too. So that's interesting, because once I was in a meeting, kind of big meeting at the university, and there was one guy, a faculty, who said something like that. You know, I used to invite my students to my home, but I stopped doing that. Because what will happen if they break their leg on the way to my home? They can sue me for, you know, breaking their leg. It's my fault because I invited them. I thought this was really terrible. Terrible thing to say. I thought, wow. I didn't talk to him afterwards, but if I talked to him afterwards, I would say, well, that's one of the least nice things I've ever heard. If my student I invited broke his or her leg on the way to my home and sued me, believe me, he would not be my student anymore within a week, I think. And they understand it too. I mean, you have to be reasonable. So don't, even though you can sue your advisor for inviting you to his home and then breaking your leg on the way, that's, if somebody does it, the trust is broken. Sorry, that's it. So that would not scare me to invite a student to my house. Teach by example. So what do I mean by that? Don't just, you know, sometimes you have to share things that are happening in your life, professional life. I don't mean revealing that you had a quarrel with your wife or something. No, that's you know, your things. Unless the student tells me about problems in his marriage, I can say, well, you know, things like that happen, you know, last month, da-da-da. You can tell a story if you want to. But again, I don't mean that. What I mean is you get a paper back from a journal. They send you a paper back with reviews, and the review is critical. Well, you can meet with your student and say, well, they just sent me this review. It doesn't make any sense, right? Well, look at it. Well, share it with them, and then talk with how you want to respond to it, what you want to do, and because they will see you in all these kind of situations, the difficult situation, how you handle problems. You can mention to them that your grant is running out and you just got a rejection, or you got a good grant. When you get a new grant, you can take them all, the students all to lunch or something. Expose yourself with those things that are not always necessarily the business of your student immediately, but they are telling them something, teaching something. Show them that you work hard. Remember from Randy Pausch, he said something like that. Sometimes people ask me, how do I become a better scientist? I tell them, well, come to my office at 11 p.m. on Friday night. Of course, that was a joke, although he probably worked very hard. Friday night, what do people do? Well, they go out and have fun, yes? And he spent it in the lab. So have them, it's incredible the kick that you get as a student. You are in the library on Friday night, and you see your advisor there also. Wow. So nice to see that. Another thing, the last one, thinking aloud. That was something that I noticed when interacting with Herb Simon. He was such a big guy to me, you know. I almost felt so little in front of him when I was meeting with him. But he was just, you know, my size. We were sitting opposite each other in a chair. And sometimes I would tell him, I would ask him a question, or I would say, tell him about a problem I was thinking about. And he did something like that, you know. He put his legs along, kind of relaxed, and said, well, let's see, if this is going that way, you know. He was thinking aloud. Why was it important for me? Because I sat in front of him, and I thought, well, I can do that too. Whatever he is saying now, there's no magic there. I can do that too. That was important, really. Realizing that that big guy also makes mistakes, also, you know, thinks, when he thinks, there's no magic in that. So when you meet with your students, think aloud also, and that is usually gives a kick, showing, yeah, nie święci garnki lepią in Polish. It's not the saints who make pottery. That's the saying in Polish. So ordinary people can do extraordinary things. Make them realize that they can do that too. Another thing is healthy environment. And I don't mean that, you know, that modern politically correct idea about healthy environment where there is no harassment. That's obvious, of course. I don't want to get into that. But what I mean is creating an atmosphere. It's something that you don't have to do it, but you do it because it's nice. So some of the things that are definitely important is think about the needs of your students. That's one of the roles of you as a parent and a leader also. Office space, equipment, their computer gets old, get them a new computer, stipend so that they have enough money to live, things like that. Also show interest in their personal development, recognize progress. Small things that you can do to recognize progress. Some things I did, when I had money, and it was funny, I had money from a grant. There's always, in US, there's always overhead. So when you want, let's say, $1 million, you ask for $1.5 million, and the 500,000 goes to the university. That's for the electricity, heating, and all kinds of things. And out of that, they usually give you a few percent. Like, you know, they will give you whatever, $10,000, $20,000, or $30,000 to you as, they call it, kickback to the principal investigator. And you can do with that money whatever you want, typically. Of course, you cannot just buy alcohol and go have fun, no, but you can buy computers, you can buy things, you can go to lunch with your lab, etc. Everything that's related to your work. When I had that money, what we did is somebody got a paper published or passed a qualifying exam. I would buy them as a reward. It used to be Palm Pilots at that time. It's like a phone, but very specialized, just addresses and calendars. Or iPod. iPod, maybe you don't know what it is, but a small device that you can use to listen to music. You know, a small thing that didn't cost much, but just a small reward. So nice, you know. When they are achieving something. Exchange of ideas. So in addition to, we had two types of meetings in my lab. Business meetings, Friday noon, when we discussed, we had lunch. I would buy lunch for that meeting from that kickback money. And we would discuss things that are kind of practical, what has to be done, what we are doing, etc. And then we would have also research meetings where somebody would give a presentation. That's an opportunity to practice presentations. If you don't have that, but you have a group of people, if your advisor has, let's say, 1, 2, 3 more students, why don't you propose that? Why don't we meet once a week and one of us will be presenting something? What can you present? Well, you can present a paper that you read, that you didn't understand fully. You present and then you talk about this. You can do it in a research meeting, but you can also do it in a with your advisor, but you can also do it in a group. So exchange of ideas. You have to facilitate that. One way of facilitating that is to encourage cooperation rather than competition. There are some environments where people keep things close to the medals. That's a saying, you know, you have medals on your breast, so you keep your cards close to the medal so that nobody sees that. That's one way of doing this, but that's not very effective, because if you do that, then you don't have the opportunity for people to criticize it, to give you feedback. Of course, there are situations where you have to do it. Like you meet people you don't know. Then you don't know if you can trust them. But inside a research group, there should be really no secrets in terms of research. If somebody abuses it, then you know, you discuss it internally, and a good leader, good advisor should make order there, right? Just make people tell everything, because the other colleagues can help. The real competition should be positive. So not I'm going to get further because I'm hiding it from the others, but competition should be like, okay, Mary has just published a paper. I'd love that too, you know? I'd love to compete with her. Go further than she is. That's a positive competition. You congratulate her. You are happy for her, but you also want to do it. It's not that you envy her. No, you want to get there too, but you are happy for her. Imagination, creative pursuits, that's a good idea. If they are curious, you know, answer questions, talk with them. Encourage them to take a variety of courses to get a broad knowledge base. Advise them which courses are good to take. And sometimes you know more than they, because you've been at the university longer. You know what good courses are. How do you know it? Your students, your prior students told you that this was a good course, so you probably know more. Identify the skills that students have to learn. So here is the list from this seminar, but you know, you have to identify them yourself. Maybe you find some of them less important than others, and take actions. Writing papers, have them write and submit papers. Ask them to present their work in the seminars, reviewing, give them papers to review. It's very normal for an advisor to get a paper to review. And if you know that one of your students knows the area, propose your student to review it. You can put your name too, like student and you. It's okay. That way you keep quality control, but you also let the student get experience in reviewing. So that's a nice thing to do. Teaching, ask them to teach a class. You are traveling for a conference, ask, well, would you like to teach a class for me? Because they are in the same area, usually they know the stuff, so they can teach. And as a student, treat this as an honor. Of course, it will take you time. It will take you 2 hours of the lecture, but a week of preparation. But it's a good experience. Then, when the advisor is writing letters of recommendation for you, can write, well, Anne has taught several classes for me, and the students love them. That's a very strong recommendation in a letter of recommendation when Anne is applying for a faculty position. Send them to conferences so they learn how science works, how to present, they interact with people. That's an important thing. If you have money, send them. I remember when I became a PhD student, after my first year, I didn't have a paper. But my advisor said, why don't you go to that conference? Because your colleague, Jayant, is going there too, and he's driving, so I'll pay your hotel and and conference fee. I went to that conference, and boy, when I came back, I thought, no way am I going without a paper next year, right? Such a motivating experience. I wanted to be like that too. I want to present. Up-to-date CV, it's an important thing for an academic to have. Teach them how to do it, show them. What else? Dishonesty. I think it's something that should not be tolerated. I would like to point out to you in Poland, one thing that is different between Poland and what I've seen in the Netherlands, United States, is this, it's in the teaching context, is dishonesty. People are acting ethically, but with, as I joke sometimes, ethically within the bounds of reason, right? They are doing dishonest things when submitting their work, you know, they're copying assignments, etc. And it's, for some reason, it's tolerated in Poland more than it is in many other countries in the world. If you are caught cheating, it's called cheating in the United States, you can actually get kicked out of the university. First time. No lenience. That's why people typically don't cheat. Of course, some people still do, but it's a very risky business. In Poland, you get cheating. What they do is sometimes you have, thank you very much, you get out of the exam, you get zero for the exam. But you can come again, and et cetera, et cetera. It's essentially tolerated. Do not tolerate it among your people. It's really very robust finding that people who are cheating at the university, they will be cheating their husbands, their wives, their friends, their business partners. Don't tolerate it. It's, you know, they are losing their virginity this way, and they are no longer virgins going out, and they will be dishonest later. Don't tolerate it. Poor quality work, don't accept it. Well, tell them, of course, what needs to be improved. Don't just say, okay, that's fine. Don't put your name on a joint paper when it's poor quality. Tell them what to improve. Improve it, show them how to improve it. Quality is important. One thing that I did, and that was a long story. I was once, of course, raised up in Poland in a communist system where there was essentially many things done completely for the, you know, for the outside, things that were just funny, they were not real. I was always very skeptical about things. The same attitude, actually, I noticed among Chinese students from communist China. I was talking once, and they said, when they had those meetings in during the Great Leap, you know, in 1960s, 70s, they would be asked to, you know, to chant slogans, down with capitalism, etc. They would just pretend to do it, very skeptical against everything who is kind of out of the ordinary. So I was also skeptical about this. But once I heard a story that made me convinced that writing a mission statement is a good idea. What is a mission statement? Essentially, it's sitting down and writing, not just saying, but writing, what am I about? What am I going to do? People can write mission statements for a company, for an organization, even for a marriage. You know, you sit down with your husband or wife and say, well, our marriage is to develop each other, you know, become better people, in harmony, loving each other, raising children who will be good people, whatever you decide. I mean, it's your business. With mission statements, I once heard a story, it's a very American story, about FedEx. And the slogan for FedEx today is, what is the slogan for FedEx? The world on time? Still, or have they changed it? I don't know. Anyway, there was a slogan in the very early days, overtime, overnight, over there. Very short one. That was kind of, you know, slogan that expressed their mission. They want to bring things from one place to another overnight. they were probably, I think, first. And the idea was that they had a central location in U.S. I forgot what it was, Minneapolis or somewhere in the middle, and then picking up letters from everywhere in the United States in the evening, flying it to that central location during the night, sorting, and then flying it out of there to the destination so that it gets there by noon the next day. Great idea, but things didn't work well. Things were kind of going down, as often they do in a startup. And then they decided to have that, to come up with a mission statement. Overnight, over there, or over there, overnight. And then I was in a workshop where a lady explained a beautiful story. Actually, I contacted FedEx to check if it's a real story. The public relations lady who responded said, well, I have never heard about it, but it's a beautiful story. So I'm not saying that this is a real story, but it sounded like that. There was a journalist from a local TV showing a truck driver, a FedEx truck, who came to pick up letters. You know, those boxes, sometimes they are in the street. I think it was in the street. And he wanted to open that box to get the letters out, but the box wouldn't open. The key didn't work. The lock got stuck somehow. So, you know, you see him looking at the watch. The flight out of that place is, let's say, 10 o'clock. It's already 8:30. What to do? You know, he has to open because there are letters in there. The key doesn't work, so he goes, he runs to the lab, to the truck, gets other keys, tries. They don't work. What he does is runs, gets bigger keys, and unscrews the whole box from the pavement. Gets the box, carries to the truck. The door in the truck are too narrow. He cannot get it in the truck. So what he does is he gets duct tape. Duct tape is, you know, Apollo 13 was repaired with duct tape. He gets the duct tape, some rope, and attaches that box to the truck, watching the time all the time, and then goes very quickly to the airport, gets that box on the plane. On the airplane, they have more time. They open it up to get to the destination. And then a journalist gets an interview with that truck driver and says, well, very few people would go that far as you did. Why did you do it? And she says, ma'am, I was just doing my job. I wanted to get those letters from here to there overnight. Wow. But were you not afraid that your manager would be mad at you that you unscrewed that whole box from the pavement? No, ma'am. The job of my manager is to get those letters from here to there overnight. No, story like this. And she told that story to make people realize that if you have a mission statement, if you have you know, something that that you can go back to, things are not going well in the company, let's sit down and talk about our main task. That helps, like in that story. I've heard people, maybe this was Stephen Covey, advocating mission statement for a family. You know, you can sit down with your husband, wife, even your children, and write down a mission statement. Why are we here? Why are we in this house? What are we doing here together? So I actually wrote a mission statement at some point, and you know, quite modest. You know, we want to do good work, name recognized, and I didn't write we want to be the best, but we want to be recognized, that people all over the world think they are doing good work there. And the reason why it was so modest, I didn't write in the statement, we want to be the best in the world, is there's a joke, there's a street with three barbers. The first barber writes, the best barber in the country. The second writes, the best barber in the world. And the third writes, the best barber in the street. So you have to be modest. Sometimes, you know, being not modest is a good idea. In the United States, in 1960s, I think it was Kennedy who said, we want to be, I think Kenneth Alden mentions that, we want to get to the moon by 1960, whatever, right? A very clear, very bright, immodest statement. It worked, right? It made people realize, okay, this is what we want to do. So sometimes a bold statement is fine, although I didn't want to sound too bold. Not the best in the world, because in science it's very difficult to judge who is the best, but definitely not difficult to judge who is good. So it may be a good idea if you have a lab, especially with many people, so that people realize what we are about. I actually have a longer document that where we actually released example journals where we want to publish, and other important aspects. I even tell that anecdote about FedEx in that longer document. Very important thing, if you want to have a working lab, is the space. Office space, really very important. If you are distributed in different places in the building, you know, you have an office there, your colleague of the same advisor has office there, that makes things difficult. It's really a good idea, if possible, to have one lab. It's difficult in many places all over the world. In academia, space is always difficult to get. Not in ideas, by the way, that's a wonderful thing. Everybody's in the same building, the same floor. But in many universities, it's very difficult to get space. It took me around 10 years, I think, to get that space. And only because my colleague, faculty colleague, used to go and smoke in that place. Smoking was forbidden in the building. He knew places where he could smoke in the winter. And that's how he knew about this space. It was unused, full of garbage. We cleaned it up and we got space without windows, but it was still a nice space. Very important. Polish time. It's really important then the neighborhood, being in physical proximity, because you see each other, you can talk about over coffee, interact. Very important. Physical proximity is very important. Carnegie Mellon, a small university, is very successful because it's so small. Philosophy is next door to statistics, really. Very close, and you can just talk with people, go to each other's seminars. So that's me. I had an aquarium in the middle. I didn't build it. It was there already. So they saw me. Another thing is when I met with a student, let's say female student, I could close the door so that we could have a conversation sometimes when it would be, let's say, going on personal things. But they saw me. They saw I didn't abuse my privileged position, right? So nobody could possibly accuse me of doing anything hunky-punky behind my door. This will pop up, keep coming up. So research space, the desks, look how beautiful they are. I had money from the grants, so I was able to buy beautiful desks and had it painted also. It was actually quite nice. Another few advice is if you are a faculty, teaching can support your research. Because when you teach, you can identify bright students and you can encourage them to apply for PhD program, to join your lab. Very good good resource, good source of students. Initial training if you teach a course in your field. Sometimes your field is very specialized, so even if you don't get credit for that, they don't pay you for that, then you can create a course and teach it for free just to be able to train people. Team building is very important. It's a concept that I've seen in many places. It's essentially making sure that people bond. It's like in the military. When the soldiers are fighting on the battlefield, there's a very good movie. If you like war movies, the movie is made by Mel Gibson. called We Were Soldiers, based on a real story, real book by Cornell Hal Moore. That movie is, according to Cornell Moore, it shows the real thing. The American soldier, or any soldier, is not fighting for the country, for the flag, for things like that. They are fighting for each other. So they are fighting for their colleagues in the battlefield. It's very important that they are bonded. They trust each other. And you have to. It's a good idea that people in a lab also are like this. So competition, collaboration, right? People are happy because others are successful. Share responsibilities, but also privileges. Responsibilities are, we had to clean that lab. You saw the lab, the kitchen. We had the kitchen, actually, very nice. It had to be cleaned once a week or so. So we had duties. I was not outside of the duties. I was one of the people who was cleaning the lab, the kitchen. Teach people to give criticism, accept criticism. We talked about this, how important it is. A feeling of permanence, that's important. When I looked around, many times people get a grant, the department gives them office space for the grant, for the project, and when the project is over, they take the space away. I thought it was a great, poor idea, so I wanted a lab, not a project. Projects come and go, we have a lab. Together you make better decisions, and you encourage people to actually make their voice heard. In our lab, we made decisions jointly, but in the mission statement, I made it very clear that because I'm responsible for the lab, financially, ethically, and whatever, I have the right to overrule the decision of the majority. I've never done it except for once when I kicked out a student. Once I kicked out a student, I told him, I don't want to be your advisor. He made a mistake of coming. I invited him to the lab meeting if he wanted to question me about this. He made the mistake of coming to that meeting, and people were actually angry with him, which was interesting. But otherwise, I've never overridden. But you have to have that right, because you are responsible financially for the whole thing. But we made decisions jointly, often voting, and I think the decisions were better because of that. That's an interesting idea, picture, probably the last one today because we are running out of time. There are not so many slides left, but this is an important picture. Both of them are from United States. These are Marines, I think. This is, you see, a coffin. Marine probably killed in action somewhere. It's a funeral. This is a retirement picture. What is the common thing in the pictures? The common thing here is that you show appreciation for, of course, for the people who the guy gave his life for the country. The lady spent years working for that company, for that organization. You should always make the arrival of new people and departure of the people an event. I've seen it sometimes, I've seen it in US also. My wife worked once in a lab where people would disappear. She notices that there's one person who hasn't been here for a month, and she asks, where is Bob? Oh, you don't know? Bob has left the lab. That's a funny thing. I noticed that a lot, actually much more in Poland, that people also are disappearing. They stopped working, they're gone. Where are they? Who knows? Never do that. Because in addition to appreciation, the people, you also give a good example to the others. Actually, the funeral with all the military honors is more important, not for the dead person, depends on your beliefs, of course, but there's a saying in Polish, it helps like incense to a dead person. It's for the people who are still alive. They know that if that happens to them, there will be full honors, orchestra, and shooting in the air. Their family, their children will be attending their funeral. Very important for a soldier. Also very important for the other employees. When I retire, they're going to give me flowers too, right? And a diploma. Very important. So remember about this. Whenever you have a new person, at least get coffee and cookies. If you don't have money in the lab for the cookies, take them out of your own pocket, the money. It's a very small amount, but make it an event. Anyway, this is the last slide. I think it's a joke. I've been fired, but they were really nice about it. Very good. I didn't finish all the slides, but there are not so many left, so I'll do it next week. I'm out of time. Sorry for extending it by, I think, a couple of minutes. Thank you very much, and we'll see you next week.